the meeting of the Committee of Health and Human Service Policy to order. We do not have a quorum, but we will continue with our presentation. And once the quorum is present, we can approve the minutes and start from there.
So, Madam Chair and members, we're now starting with the health care program. So we're at the start of the slide deck. So this would be slide one.
So what page is
page one of your copies.
Okay. So if the testifier can give us your name.
Sure. And it's Randy Chen with House Research. So this, let's see. Oh, there. Okay, sorry. All right. So this first chart basically shows the base funding for the fiscal 2021 biennium for the major agencies that are fall under the committee's jurisdiction. And as you can see,
Dunn. So we do have a quorum. So what I would like to ask, may we have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. All right. So we can continue, Mr. Chan.
So, Madam Chair, this first chart shows the budgets for the next biennium for the major departments. This is base funding. And as you can see, the human services budget has by far the bulk of the base spending at, 96.7%. Then the health department at 2.9%. MNsure, which is the health state health insurance exchange, 0.2%, and 0.2% for health-related boards and other boards and agencies. So today we'll be focusing on the healthcare programs, but there's some sort of general principles for Department of Human Services programs that we'll go over. First of all, these programs are state-supervised and county-administered. So DHS is the primary agency that oversees the human services programs. They supervise program administration by the counties, ensure compliance with federal requirements, make rules, and also provide training and other technical assistance to counties. The counties would administer the programs. They would accept applications, determine eligibility, oftentimes contract with local service providers. The U.S. Congress, passes laws and sets the general standards and requirements for most of the DHS programs. And then the legislature sets the human services policy for the state. And, often we do this, to comply with federal requirements. This next bar chart, these are just the major programs within the Department of Human Services. Again, spending for the next biennium. And here you can see that over three-quarters of the budget would be for the medical assistance program. So we're going to focus on the DHS healthcare programs. So in general, in Minnesota, persons with low to moderate incomes can obtain subsidized coverage through three main programs. So MA is the state's Medicaid program, administered within federal guidelines. Minnesota CARE was established as a state program in 1992. Since 2015, it's operated as a basic health program under the Affordable Care Act. And then MNsure is the state's health insurance exchange. It basically links persons to coverage under both the state programs and also private sector programs, and it administers premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. So together, these three programs or systems provide a rough continuum of coverage for many Minnesotans. For example, for adults without children and also parents and caretakers, they would normally be covered under medical assistance up to 133% of the federal poverty guidelines. And again, I'll remind members that in your folders, there's a DHS table with the federal poverty guidelines for the different groups. Then Minnesota CARE coverage should be available for persons with incomes over 133 up to 200% of the poverty guidelines, and then venture tax credits over 200 to 400% of the federal poverty guidelines. And covered services and enrollee costs would vary across this continuum. So now turn to the medical assistance program. It's a jointly funded federal-state program that pays for health care services to eligible low-income persons. Again, it's the state's Medicaid program, and federal government established Medicaid in 1965. So each state has its own Medicaid program, and the actual specifics of the programs vary, you know, across the states. So the programs are different. The county agencies administer medical assistance under the supervision of DHS, and counties also determine eligibility for persons who are elderly, blind, or have disabilities. The Minnesota Eligibility Technology System is used by DHS and the counties to determine eligibility for families and children and adults without children, and METS is a system that was developed in coordination with the MinSure Insurance Exchange. DHS has two main systems to deliver services to MA enrollees. First, there is a fee-for-service system. DHS would reimburse providers using fee schedules that are established by the agency. DHS also contracts with managed care and county-based purchasing plans, and it provides these plans with a monthly capitation payment for each enrollee. In order to be eligible for medical assistance, you need to belong to the eligible group, meet income standards and any applicable asset limits, be a U.S. citizen or legal non-citizen, and MA also provides 3 months of retroactive coverage from the time of application if the person would have been eligible, you know, for those previous 3 months.
Mr. Chung.
Yes.
Thank you. Can we go back to slide 9 for a moment? Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System, mm-hmm. and I'm also in Health and Human Service Finance. And we were just told that that system is called MAXIS.
Madam Chair,
the MATS?
There are actually, I guess, two eligibility systems being used. METS, or the system that's sort of tied to MinSure, is used to determine eligibility for families and children and adults without children. MAXIS is DHS's sort of legacy system. It used to be used for all, you know, MA enrollees. Now it's used primarily for persons who are elderly, blind, or disabled.
Mm. Thank you. Continue, please.
Sure. So regarding eligible groups, MA coverage is available for children, parents and caretakers, pregnant women, persons with disabilities, the elderly, and adults without children. And adults without children are sort of the newest large group that's been added. They've been eligible since January 1st of 2014. This is part of the Affordable Care Act expansion option. And extending coverage to this group essentially allows the program to cover all major groups of individuals. Prior to this expansion, adults without children were covered only if they met some other group criterion, such as being over age 65 or disabled. This slide shows some of the MA income limits. So the income limits vary by eligibility group. They range from 100% of poverty for persons who are elderly, blind, or have disabilities, and going up to 283% of poverty for children under age 2. So what this means is that people in the same family may not all be eligible for medical assistance. Parents, for example, will sometimes be eligible for Minnesota Care, and the children would be on medical assistance. MA uses an income methodology to determine what income to count. So the MA program excludes or disregards certain types of income. Since January of 2014, the Affordable Care Act has required states to use what's called the Modified Adjusted Gross Income System, or MAGI, for parents, children, pregnant women, and adults without children. And we use an existing prior state income methodology for groups that are elderly, have disabilities.
Mr.
And,
Jones?
Yes.
Thank you. We have a question from Chair Liebley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Chun, I just wanted to ask about what you just went through on slide 13 about the different income limits. And, of course, it's been sort of an issue that the last two lines there, and I just wanted to flag it for members, too, that if you're aged, blind, or disabled, you have to be poorer to get on medical assistance than you do if you're just an adult, if you're not, which kind of seems to be standing it on its head. And I wonder if you could just kind of remind us of how we ended up in that bizarre place where people without disabilities are allowed to have more money and still go on MA than if they have a disability.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. So a couple of things. So some of these, I think, income standards are sort of tied to Fed requirements, federal law. But I think most recently, the Affordable Care Act really expanded eligibility mainly for adults without children and parents. It didn't really touch eligibility for the group, you know, the aged, blind, and disabled group. I think part of that was because the federal government might have felt that there was already a Medicare system, you know, in place, and, you know, perhaps for cost reasons or other reasons, you know, focused on expanding to new groups without existing sources of coverage. And also mentioned that federal law, and I think probably state practice, tended to place, a lot of importance on children and people in their developmental years. So that's probably one reason why the income limits for children are higher than, say, for parents.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I could. Thank you for that, Mr. Chun. And I think that's a pretty good explanation. It's sort of a historical fluke, in a way, that that's the case. And just for newer members, you know, there have been efforts to try to fix that, but it's very, very expensive to fix. But, Mr. Chun, if we were, what it basically means is that somebody who's disabled might choose to not apply through the disability portal, if you will, because they'd actually do better under applying as non-disabled, unless they needed the special additional benefits that might go along with being on a waiver.
Yes, that's correct. I think individuals normally would have the option to choose the eligibility category that's most advantageous to them.
Right. And, Madam Chair, and just to kind of finish the thought, that what that really means is that when we look at, you know, just adults on MA, some of those adults, I don't know what the share of them would be, but a lot of them would, in fact, be people who have disabilities who just didn't come in through that door, but came in through the regular door. But I know this kind of came up when we talked about some people were proposing putting a bunch of additional requirements on, not realizing that, you know, who may be in this pool that we're talking about, that a lot of them, in fact, are people with disabilities. So I just wanted to raise that issue.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Slide 10, we talk about how the DHS has two systems to deliver services. Do we have any information on what percentage goes for fee-for-service and which percentage of that whole pot goes to the managed care? And do we have any information on health care outcomes between the two systems?
Madam Chair, yes, we would have sort of enrollment information. I don't have enrollment information for the same month in this slide. I think I have a slide that shows the managed care enrollment versus total enrollment, you know, for sort of recent months together to give a very rough estimate. It, you know, it's something like 70 or 80% of people are being served in MA on managed care. I don't know whether there have been any recent analyses of, say, you know, quality of care. And that's something maybe I can check with Department of Human Services and sort of follow up with them.
Representative Mann.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chong, you can continue.
So, Madam Chair, individuals who have an income above the MA income limit can also qualify for the program by spending down. This would be done by incurring medical bills that are equal to or greater than the amount of income that they have that is in excess of the following spend-down limits. And these limits are 133% of poverty for families and children, 80% of the poverty guidelines for persons who are elderly, blind, or have disabilities. And this will be going up to 81% effective June 1st of 2019. And there's no spend-down option for the Adults Without Children group. Some MA enrollees need to meet asset standards. There are no asset limits for pregnant women, children, parents and caretakers who are not on a spend-down, and adults without children. So this was part of the ACA, Affordable Care Act, compliance. So asset standards would apply to parents and caretakers on a spend-down, and the amounts are listed here, and persons who are elderly, blind, or have disabilities. MA covers all federally mandated and most optional health care services. Federal law kind of distinguishes between required and optional services, but optional services are still services that, you know, people often often need are quite important. I mean, these include, for example, chiropractic services, dental services, certain mental health services, you know, prescription drugs. The MA benefit set tends to be comprehensive compared to private sector coverage. For example, MA usually covers a wider range of long-term care services. And the ACA requires states to provide the newly eligible group, which would be the Adults Without Children in Minnesota, with what they call benchmark or benchmark equivalent benefits. And Minnesota has basically just chosen to use its regular Medicaid benefit set for this new group of enrollees that was allowed by the federal government. The MA program does not charge enrollee premiums. Enrollees are subject to a family deductible and their various co-payments. Cost sharing is required by federal law to be nominal for most MA enrollees. And children and pregnant women are exempt from medical assistance cost-sharing requirements. The MA program is financed by both the state and federal government. The federal government provides a 50% match toward the cost of MA services. The state general fund pays the remaining 50%, and for certain services there is a county share. The Federal Children's Health Insurance Program provides an enhanced match of 88% for the cost of certain services. So this is through federal fiscal year 2019, and then it will eventually reduce to the regular CHIP enhanced match of 65%. For the adults without children who were covered under the ACA expansion option, the federal government provides a match currently of 93% for 2019. I didn't update this slide, and this it phases down to 90% for 2020 and future years. The next several slides will go over medical assistance managed care, and this is getting to the earlier question. So a majority of MA enrollees receive covered services through either HMOs or a county-based purchasing plan. And a county-based purchasing plan is basically a health plan operated by a county board or a group of county boards, and they receive the same capitation payment as HMOs would. So this just shows that for July of 18, MA managed care enrollment was a bit over 890,000. Number of MA enrollees, not for the same month, but May of 2018, about 1.1 million. So families and children, adults without children, and the elderly are required to enroll in a managed care plan. Persons with disabilities are allowed to opt out, but if they do not choose to affirmatively opt out, they will then be served under managed care.
Okay, Representative Edelson.
Thank you. I just wanted to know Thank you, Madam Chairman. I wanted to know, under the managed care, who are the providers under the HMOs? Do you have a list of them?
Madam Chair, Representative Ellison, it would really depend upon the providers that each HMO wanted to contract with. I believe that there are about five HMOs and three county-based purchasing plans, and then within that, they would establish their own provider networks and establish their own provider payment rates, for example.
Representative Ellison.
I was just curious in terms of, is it Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medica? Do we have a list? An exhaustive list to be able to show that? I'm just curious.
Well, this is as of about a year ago, but the plans were Blue Plus, Health Partners, UCare, Medica, although they, I think, for a while had stopped accepting enrollment, and a Metropolitan Health Plan, and then Hennepin Health, Itasca Medical Care, Prime West, and South Country Health Alliance. And the last three plans are county-based purchasing plans.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Mr. John, you can continue.
So each managed care plan needs to provide or arrange for most MA-covered services, including up to 180 days of nursing home services and also elderly waiver services. And as was just mentioned, each HMO or county-based purchasing plan determines its own provider network and sets its own provider payment rates. Since 2012, Medicaid has used competitive bidding to provide services, or to choose, I guess, HMOs and county-based purchasing plans to provide services to MA enrollees. So 2016 was the first statewide enrollment based upon competitive bidding. DHS plans to seek competitive bids to provide services beginning in 2020 for MA families and children in Minnesota, and then to seek competitive bids to provide services in 2021 to serve families and children in the metro area. I'd like to just, this slide is just on one of the larger demonstration projects that the state has. This is the Integrated Health Partnership Demonstration Project. This is a healthcare provider direct contracting program. So DHS contracts with groups of healthcare providers that are called Integrated Health Partnerships to provide services to both MA and Minnesota care enrollees, and it operates for both the fee-for-service and the managed care system. Under this demonstration project, all of the integrated health partnerships receive a population-based payment for care coordination, and then the larger, more integrated IHPs would be paid under a risk-gain sharing arrangement where the IHP might have to share savings or losses, with the state. As of 2018, there were 24 IHPs that provided services to 450,000 state program enrollees, most of these in medical assistance. And DHS has estimated that total savings for 2013, which was the start of this project, through 2017 to be about $277 million, of which a portion was returned to IHPs as shared savings. And this slide shows MA spending and MA enrollment numbers. And I could stop there if there are more questions on MA.
Okay, members, do we have any questions? All right, let's continue.
Excuse me. So, Madam Chair, members, Minnesota Care is a jointly funded federal-state program. It provides subsidized coverage mainly to parents and caretakers and adults without children. So it's established in 1992 as part of broader health care access legislation. And it's operated as a basic health program under the ACA since 2015. I'll pass over this slide. This slide just provides a little bit of information on the basic health program. The Minnesota CARE program is administered by the state through the Department of Human Services Central Office. So it's a little bit different from MA, where the counties play more of a role. So the Department of Human Services contracts with managed care and county-based purchasing plans to provide services. And the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System, or METS, this is the MNSHR-related system, is used to determine eligibility. In order to be eligible for Minnesota CARE, a person must meet income limits. There is no asset limit for the program. They would need to meet requirements related to lack of access to health insurance and not be MA eligible, be a Minnesota resident, and be a citizen or legal non-citizen. So the income limits for Minnesota CARE are between 133% to 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. And these are this is the income limit that's required for the basic health program under the ACA. And there are certain exceptions to this income floor for certain groups and also legal non-citizens. And the thinking here is that persons under 133% of poverty would normally be able to attain medical assistance coverage, whereas persons with incomes higher than 200% of poverty could receive subsidized coverage through the MNSHR insurance exchange. So these would be the premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. As I mentioned, there is no asset limit for the Minnesota CARE program. This is part of ACA compliance. There are some requirements related to lack of insurance or not having other insurance. Persons must not have minimum essential coverage, and this is the definition of health coverage used under the Affordable Care Act. Persons must also not have access to subsidized coverage that is affordable and provides minimum value. And since 2014, persons who are eligible for medical assistance are not eligible for Minnesota CARE. Prior to this date, a person could choose, you know, either program. So this has had the effect of shifting most children and pregnant women from Minnesota CARE to the MA program, since the MA income limits for these groups are higher than the Minnesota CARE limits. The Minnesota CARE program has several benefit sets. Pregnant women and children have access to the broadest range of services, nearly all MA benefits, then parents and adults without children who are not pregnant. And this meets the benefit set meets the ACA requirement that a basic health plan provide at least the essential health benefits, and we'll go over the essential health benefits in a later slide. Premiums are charged to Minnesota CARE enrollees who are aged 21 and older based on a sliding scale. Children are exempt from premiums. Persons with incomes below 35% of the poverty guidelines pay no premiums, and American Indians and Alaska Natives are also exempt. And recently in 2015, premiums were increased for certain of the relatively higher income enrollees. There are various co-payment and co-insurance requirements, and I'll just mention that the cost-sharing requirements and also the covered services, both for the MA program that we went over and the Minnesota CARE program, are on a one-page double-sided handout that's in your folder called Minnesota Healthcare Program Summary of Coverage, Cost-Sharing, and Limits. So that will provide more information. So there are various, copayment and coinsurance requirements. Pregnant women and children and American Indians and Alaska Natives are exempt from cost sharing. Cost sharing was recently increased in 2016, and the Department of Human Services is required to adjust cost sharing to maintain an actuarial value of 94%. And I'll just mention that actuarial value is the percentage of total average health care costs for covered benefits that are paid by the health plan. The Minnesota CARE program is financed by a 2% tax on the gross revenues of health care providers. This will be sunsetting beginning in calendar year 2020. There's also a 1% tax on premiums for nonprofit health plans. And some money from these taxes is deposited into the Healthcare Access Fund. As a basic health program, the state receives from the federal government 95% of the value of premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions that would otherwise have been provided had the Minnesota Care program, you know, not existed, and persons would be on the exchange receiving tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. I'll just mention that the federal government, and I'll go over this later as well, but the federal government relatively recently stopped reimbursing health plans for the cost-sharing reductions that they provide to people receiving coverage on the exchange. This may have some effect on federal funding for this program. I think that's still being sort of negotiated between the state and the federal government. And federal funding from this is deposited into the state's basic health program trust fund. And this is a slide showing spending and enrollment for the Minnesota Care program. And I could also stop here for questions.
Okay, members, do we have any questions? Have a good day. Continue on.
So, Madam Chair and members, we'll now move to the MnSure Health Insurance Exchange and some of the subsidies that are available through the exchange. So the Affordable Care Act required states, or if states did not act, required the federal government to establish health insurance exchanges for the individual and small group markets. So Minnesota in 2013 passed legislation to establish a state-run exchange, which is called MnSure. So the exchange facilitates the selection and purchase of health coverage by individuals and families. And there's a typo on your paper slide. Small employers should read families. And the exchange also determines eligibility for premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. And the exchange under the AC was intended to be sort of a common entry point for persons to obtain either coverage through a state program or coverage from one of the private plans offered through the exchange system. The federal government provides premium tax credits and pays for the cost of these tax credits through the exchange. The Affordable Care Act requires insurers to provide cost-sharing reductions for persons with low to moderate incomes. These cost-sharing reductions have not been paid since October of 2017. In order to be eligible for exchange subsidies, a person would need to meet the general requirements for just obtaining coverage generally from the exchange. This would be that they be a citizen or legal non-citizen and also not incarcerated. In Minnesota, their income must be greater than 200% of the poverty guidelines, but not exceed 400% of the poverty guidelines. The upper limit for cost-sharing reductions is 250% of the poverty guidelines. A person also has to be not covered by Medicaid, Medicare, Minnesota Care, or employer or other coverage. The exchange plans cover the essential health benefits that are required by the Affordable Care Act. There are 10, I guess, major categories of essential health benefits, so the second bullet lists those 10 categories. The enrollee is responsible for paying premiums for the insurance policy that they choose through the exchange, but they may be eligible for a premium tax credits. And premium tax credits basically limit your payment for health coverage to a certain percentage of income, which ranges from 6.54% of income for persons at about 200% of poverty to 9.86% of income for persons at 400% of poverty. So the amount of the tax credit would be the cost of the policy you choose, and it's tied to the cost of what's called the second lowest cost silver plan. These plans are classified by metal level depending upon the actuarial value. So, for example, their bronze, silver, gold, and platinum plans. The bronze plan has a 60% actuarial value, going up to a platinum plan with 90% actuarial value. So your tax credit is the difference between the cost of the second lowest silver plan in your area minus what your expected enrollee contribution was, those percentages that were mentioned earlier. So this next slide, the title should actually read cost-sharing subsidies. So health insurers are required to provide cost-sharing subsidies to persons with incomes not exceeding 250% of poverty, and they would need to purchase a silver-level plan. The effect of the cost-sharing subsidy would be to increase the actuarial value of the plan from 70 to 73%. This is often done by reducing a plan's annual out-of-pocket limit, but plans have flexibility in how they want to achieve this higher actuarial value. Insurers had been reimbursed by the federal government for the cost of providing these cost-sharing reductions, but since October of 2017, the federal government has terminated cost-sharing payments to these insurers, but the requirement still applies to insurers, so analysts sort of project that this will lead to higher premiums. So the federal government pays all of the cost of the premium tax credits, and these are paid as reimbursements to the insurers. And this just shows that for 2017, Minsure enrollees were projected to receive $372 million in premium tax credits, and the average monthly tax credit for a household as of November of 2018 was $475 a month. And I can stop there for any questions on Minsure.
Okay, members, do we have any questions? Continue on, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research. I'm going to talk about two programs that were established in 2017 to try to contain the cost of individual market premiums in the state. And this starts on slide 45. The first one is the Premium Subsidy Program. It was established in 2017, and it operated for calendar year 2017 only. The Office of Department of Minnesota Management and Budget administered the program, and it reduced, if an enrollee was enrolled in the individual market, it reduced the cost of premiums by 25%. The program provided about $137 million in subsidies for approximately 118,000 enrollees. And then the second program was called the Minnesota Premium Security Plan. It's also called reinsurance. It was enacted in April 2017, and it began operation in January 2018. It's administered by the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, which is called MCHA. And it operates so that if an enrollee has individual market coverage and they have claim costs that exceed the attachment point for the program, which is currently $50,000, the reinsurance program pays for 80% of the enrollee's claims up to a cap of $250,000. And then the insurer is responsible for claims costs above that cap amount. And payment is made to the insurer. And the plan is funded mainly with federal funds and state money from the general fund and the health care access fund.
Okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question. When will we get information on how that money has been utilized in MCHA from Commerce?
Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, I checked with our Commerce analyst last week, and she didn't have anything yet, but I can have her reach out to Commerce and see.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz. Okay. Continue, Mrs. Oh. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have we seen premium reductions from reinsurance?
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, it's my understanding that there was about a 20% premium reduction from reinsurance.
And how much state money has been spent on reinsurance?
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, we transferred $200 million in fiscal year 18 and $200 million in fiscal year 19 from the Health Care Access Fund into the reinsurance account. And then we also transferred $71 million in 18 and $71 million in 19 from the general fund. And so that all that, that's the state money that was transferred to the account. I don't know how much of it's been used.
Okay.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there enough money to continue the reinsurance then?
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, it's my understanding that there's no like ongoing funding for this program. So at some point there will need to be a reinfusion.
Okay.
It's certainly solvent for the
near future.
Well, at least or? I think through 22.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Clarkquist.
Chair Liebling, I'm sorry.
So for this so-called reinsurance program, was anything required of the insurance companies in order to receive this money? I mean, did the statute say you must reduce premiums by some amount, or did it say you must, improve coverage, or did it say anything related to the income levels of anybody who was going to be the beneficiary of this? If you could tell us that.
Mrs. Clark.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, so the way reinsurance operates, it's based on the claims. So it's not based on an enrollee's income or anything like that. I think it's meant to remove the some of the burden of more expensive enrollees with more expensive claim costs, kind of remove that burden from the premium amount, if that makes sense. And there's nothing in the reinsurance language that says anything about insurers have to reduce costs by or reduce premium amounts by X amount.
Right. So, Madam Chair.
Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Clarkquist. So, I think we all kind of understand the theory behind it. You know, insurance companies collect premiums and then, they calculate what they think their expenses are going to be, and they presumably collect enough premiums to cover what those expenses are. And so by having the state pay some of their expenses, one might presume that they would then reduce premiums. But my understanding, there was absolutely nothing in the legislation that required that. If we continue on, if there was enough money to continue under the current legislation anyway, there is absolutely nothing to guarantee that they will continue. And as I understood it, different insurance companies reduced premiums by different amounts. So this isn't, I think that the 20% was an average maybe, right?
No, so yeah, that's correct.
And as you point out, and I think it's really important to note that there was absolutely nothing to say that the benefit of this would be any more for somebody who's right at that cliff where they have to pay their own freight for their premium, that right above the 400% of the federal poverty level, where they no longer are eligible for any of the premium tax credit. They're paying the full freight. Where somebody who earns three or four or five times that much, everybody would get essentially the same benefit under this program. So I just want to flag that as, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of discussion this session about whether this, the wisdom of that, the wisdom of continuing that, and how we're going to deal with this problem of a very small slice of our population who is in this really bad situation of having some pretty steep costs for their insurance.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm also concerned about the sustainability of a reinsurance program. We don't have $500 million every biennium. to help pay the claims. I'm wondering, this MSHA, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, that was created in January 2018, I know they were searching for an executive director. Do you know if they were able to hire anyone and what the cost that is to create this new association that helps administer this claim system reinsurance?
Ms. Clarkin.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, it's my understanding that MCHA was already in existence. MCHA is the entity that operated the state's high-risk pool. We had a high-risk pool, so prior to the ACA. I don't know whether it hired an executive director or anything like that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Schultz.
That's it.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question in terms of how the federal or these subsidy dollars come in and impact the premiums being paid out. And what I'm referring to is, if I remember right, under the Affordable Care Act, that 80% of the premiums paid in, at least 80% of the premiums paid in, have to go to health care costs. You can't have more than 20% administrative costs, et cetera. So how does all these millions of dollars that we're putting in impact that? Does that mean they only have to consider the premiums they put in, and they could keep the rest of this to cover administrative costs, which would actually raise what they can spend on administrative costs? Or is this part of what is supposed to be keeping premiums down at that 80% and therefore reducing premiums?
Mrs. Clark.
Madam Chair and Representative Fisher, let me consult with Mr. Chun for a minute. Madam Chair and Representative Fisher, Mr. Chun and Mr. Berg and I don't know the answer to your question.
Representative Fisher.
Oh, I think that's a pretty important part. It'd be nice to be able to get an answer on that, because I'd be real concerned is if they only have to pay out 80% of premiums and they're paying hundreds of million dollars on top of that, they can use that to start inflating their administrative costs or going to profits within their own company. I'd be very concerned that's where taxpayer dollars are going. So I would appreciate at some point being able to find out what's happening there.
Thank you. Representative Elderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am curious, in terms of the reinsurance, how many Minnesotans are actually beneficiaries of this cost reduction that they saw in their premiums?
Madam Chair and Representative Edelson, I will have to check on that and see how many enrollees have been served through reinsurance.
Okay. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond for a moment to Representative Fisher and just to say that, you know, these are important questions, but I think this isn't the right group to ask, because they're trying to give us these overviews and they're trying to cover these broad range of things that all fit together. But I think this is more of a commerce question. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Chair Halverson is going to be dealing with this and unpacking it in her committee, but I think that's probably who would be better able to answer the question. So I just want to kind of jump to the defense of our brave House research folks here who try to answer all questions, even if it's not really in their expertise.
And I agree with you, Chair Liebling, that, you know, we want to keep in mind this is a policy committee. So if we can just stay focused around the policy pieces of this, that would be great. I know those are really good questions, though. Representative Keel.
I'll
okay. I do have one question myself. So did you state that for those who are a part of the reinsurance, that there's no income limit, no income eligibility?
Madam Chair, that's correct. These are just enrollees who are buying insurance on the individual market. And if they have claims costs that exceed the attachment point of $50,000, the insurer gets money from the reinsurance program to pay for those claims costs. So no money goes to the enrollee.
Sure. But, Mrs. Clark, are you mm-hmm. saying that they could be millionaires and billionaires and they're getting subsidies from the state?
Any individual market enrollee who has claims costs that exceed the attachment point, yes, up to the cap of $250,000. Mm-hmm. Yep. If they have individual market coverage.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one last comment to Representative Fisher. So they submit the claim and then it gets reimbursed from this fund, state funds that we're allocating. What's being proposed rule change at the federal level is that the 80% that they're required to pay out now could be 70%. So they're lowering the expectations from health plans. So we should keep our eye on if that rule change goes forward at the federal level.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Keough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Clarkvest, what kind of people are in the 50 to the 250,000 claim range? What kind of groups are those? What diseases? What?
Madam Chair and Representative Keough, I'm sorry, I don't know. I think it could be a range of chronic conditions or acute conditions.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we members have any other questions? Okay, let's continue, Ms. Clark.
Madam Chair, Danielle Pinelli from House Research. I am going to continue on now with a brief discussion of long-term care. And this begins on slide number 47. Long-term care services are available to the elderly and people with disabilities through MA, state programs, and programs administered by the Board on Aging. The long-term care services provided under MA include a broad range of services such as nursing facility services, intermediate care facilities for persons with developmental disabilities, home health care, personal assistance services, and home and community-based waiver services. And I will briefly go through each of these. But first, let me back up and just reiterate something that Mr. Chun mentioned earlier. For the MA programs, a person eligible under the elderly or disabled categories must meet income and asset standards that are lower than the standards for other eligibility categories. And they also have other eligibility requirements that they need to meet. For example, to be eligible as elderly, a person must be age 65 or older. And to be eligible as a person with disabilities, the person must satisfy the disability criteria that are used by the Federal Social Security Administration or the state medical review team. The nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities are both institutions. The other services on this list are all home and community-based services. PCA services are actually scheduled to be replaced by a new program that the Department of Human Services is currently working on creating beginning June 2020. The new program is called Community First Services and Supports, and that program is fairly similar to the PCA program. It's a self-directed program for home and community-based services for people living in the community who need help with daily activities. However, the Community First Services and Supports program is designed to give the person more control, flexibility, responsibility, and choice in how they use the service. For the home and community-based waiver services, there are actually five different waiver services. Home and community-based waivers cover two different types of services. These are services that are necessary to avoid institutionalization that are not covered under the regular MA state plan, and also services that are extensions of Minnesota's MA state plan services. The Department of Human Services has to apply to the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for these waivers to cover services not normally covered under MA state plan. And the five home and community-based waivers that we have in Minnesota are four of them are related to disabilities, and the fifth one is the elderly waiver. The first The first waiver program is community alternative care, which provides services for people with chronic illnesses who need the level of care provided in a hospital. The second waiver program is community access for disability inclusion, which is often called CADI. It provides services for persons with disabilities who need the level of care provided in a nursing home. The developmental disabilities, or DD waiver, provides services to people who need the level of care provided in an intermediate care facility for persons with developmental disabilities. The brain injury waiver provides services to persons with a traumatic or acquired brain injury who need the level of care provided in a nursing home or a neurobehavioral hospital. And then finally, elderly waiver provides services for the elderly who are at risk of nursing home placement. The long-term care programs that are provided by the state include long-term care consultation services, which provide screening, assessment, and information and education services to help individuals access and decide on the appropriate level of long-term care services. The alternative care program provides home and community-based services to individuals who are not MA enrollees but who are at risk of nursing home placement. This program is quite similar to the elderly waiver program, but it's for people who do not yet qualify for MA. Just one note on this program, it used to be a state-only funded program, but back in 2014, the state began to receive federal Medicaid match for this program. Family Support Grants is a program that provides state cash assistance for maintaining a child with developmental disabilities or a related condition in the family home. The funds are for those expenses that are incurred as a result of the disability. The Consumer Support Grant Program is a state-funded alternative to MA-reimbursed home care, specifically home care services of a home health aide, a PCA, and a home care nurse. And this is another program that is scheduled to be replaced by the new Community First Services and Supports program in June of 2020. The next program is Semi-Independent Living Services, or SILS.
I have a question here. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Daniele. And this might be more of a question that we should get follow-up information from DHS on, but most of these waivers were designed to help people stay in the community as long as possible and avoid going to institutional care or more expensive clustered care. People don't like the word institutional, but sometimes independent living with services can feel institutional. Sometimes assisted living can be. You know, people differ in their words. But my sense is that we're really drifting away from that now for a variety of reasons, including the workforce shortage. And I'm wondering if we could get some data on whether these programs are still achieving their goal of delaying people going into those dramatically more expensive settings, or whether there's some things we could do if I'm right, that more people are shifting to the more expensive services, if there's anything we could do to help shore up their staying in the community as long as they can safely and want to.
Ms. Pinelli?
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, my sense is that the trend is still that we continue to serve more people in the community than in institutions, but I can certainly check with DHS and get more information on that.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, continuing on, the last program listed on this slide is the Essential Community Support Services, and that's a program that was created to provide support services to people who are no longer eligible for nursing facility services or certain waiver services due to changes that were made in the nursing facility level of care that took effect on January 1st of 2015. And this benefit is limited to $424 per month in services and supports. The next slide is a slide that shows MA enrollees and expenditures by enrollee type. So it's broken out by the categories of children and parents, persons with disabilities, adults without children, and the elderly. And basically what you can see from this slide is that the percentage of enrollees who are persons with disabilities or the elderly are fairly small compared to the amount of expenditures that the state makes in those same categories.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Puniele, I just wanted to ask you kind of this slide, really, this is a really important slide. And just to sort of put a point on it again, that some of these people who are even in here as adults without children may, in fact, also be persons with disabilities, right? I mean, it's just a classification thing and how easy it is to get in under one umbrella versus another. And so I think it's, and probably the same thing could be said of, I'm just surmising, and I kind of like your opinion on this, even under the children and parents rubric, I mean, let's face it, a lot of the reason that people are poor can be because they have a disability, right? If somebody has something that impacts their ability to either get education or to earn money, it's going to impact their income, and they may put them in these categories. So I just like your comment on that.
Ms. Benelli.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that's correct. I have heard that if a person is able to enter medical assistance through one of these other categories, if they're eligible under another category and they don't have to go through the disability determination process, which can be quite a lengthy process, that people can and do that.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Please continue.
Madam Chair, the final slide relating to long-term care is just a listing of the programs that are administered by the Board on Aging. You can see the listing there. I can go into more detail if members are interested. The just one thing I would say sort of generally is that the Board on Aging is a 25-member board whose members are appointed by the governor. Staff are provided by the Department of Human Services, and the board is housed within that agency. And one of the primary functions of the board is to administer federal Older Americans Act funding.
Madam Chair, Randy Chen with House Research. We'll now move to the chemical and mental health program area. So starting first with substance use disorder treatment, there are three main categories of substance use disorder services. There are the assessment services. So this would be the what's known as a Rule 25 assessment. So it's an interview with the counselor to assess a person's substance use and substance use disorder treatment needs, and also provide placement. So this is conducted by a county or tribal agency. I'll just mention that there was 2017 legislation that would allow an individual to go directly to a provider rather than a county assessor for this assessment. And this is something that's being phased in over a two-year period through June of 2020. And then there are the treatment services that are listed here, and then finally recovery services. So counties and tribes play a role. They would assess the treatment needs of a resident, again, as was mentioned, using a Rule 25 assessment. They would determine financial eligibility for publicly funded treatment, and then also do pre-authorization and placement in the appropriate treatment services. Counties are also responsible for providing a share of the cost. This would be 22.95% of the costs for non-medical assistance enrollees and 30% of the costs for MA enrollees. Publicly funded substance use disorder treatment is provided either through the managed care system, or if it's provided through the fee-for-service system, it's sort of funded through the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. So in order to be eligible for funding from this fund, the recipient must meet the, first of all, clinical requirements, then have no insurance to cover the cost of treatment, and either be on a public health program, or if they're not in a public health program, to meet the treatment fund income and household guidelines. Can move now to mental health. The counties are responsible for developing the mental health systems for children and adults. The programs and services that they operate need to comply with the requirements in Minnesota law in the Children's Mental Health Act and the Adult Mental Health Act. And funding comes from a variety of sources, federal, state, and county. There is also funding through for services through MA and Minnesota Care and also private insurance. This slide sort of outlines the six main components of mental health service delivery. First, there is the diagnostic assessment, which is the initial assessment to obtain mental health services. Then there are several other assessments, a functional assessment and a level of care assessment. These are used to determine, I guess, whether you're eligible for certain types of services, so the level of services that you're provided. And then an individual treatment plan is developed. There's a delivery of services and then a reassessment process. And this slide just lists the types of mental health services, grouping them to three categories, emergency services, residential services, and non-residential services. And this next slide, it basically shows the continuum of mental health services. So adult and children's services are, you know, sort of at times called different names, but this just depicts the services from the lowest level of need, you know, outpatient services, all the way up to sort of inpatient and residential services. The state, through the Department of Human Services, provides what are called state-operated services for individuals with complex needs related to mental illness, substance use disorder, developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injury, and also those who are committed as mentally ill or dangerous. And this is a DHS slide. I know it's sort of hard to see, but it shows the locations and types of direct care and treatment facilities. So there are several, I guess, categories of direct care and treatment services. There are adult mental health services, which would be inpatient treatment at community behavior health hospitals and also at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, or also services through the Minnesota Specialty Health System, which is located in Brainerd. There are services for persons committed as mentally ill and dangerous through the Minnesota Security Hospital at St. Peter. There are child and adolescent behavioral health services, community addiction recovery enterprise services or care services. These are inpatient and outpatient CD and substance abuse services that are available statewide in six locations. Community support services would consist of residential support services, vocational and day training and habilitation services for persons with developmental disabilities or a traumatic brain injury. There are rehabilitation services for persons with serious brain injuries and neurocognitive disorders. There are forensic services listed there and also community dental services, which are available at five sites statewide. DHS also operates the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. This provides court-ordered treatment for individuals civilly committed by the court as sexually dangerous persons or as having a sexual psychopathic personality. And as of June of 2018, 736 individuals were receiving these services at two different sites. There was a recent federal lawsuit. The district court initially ruled that the MSOP program was unconstitutional. Then a circuit court of appeals sort of reversed this decision there was an appeal to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court chose not to hear the case. So as a result, the district court, you know, dismissed all remaining claims in August of 2018. And that concludes both this section and our presentation.
Do you have any questions, members?
Actually, Madam Chair. Okay, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to go back to the state, what we used to call state-operated services. I think I lost my page on it here. But, Mr. Chun, you were talking 30. Is it slide 30?
I think it begins on slide 60.
Page 30. Okay. See, I'm not far enough in the packet here. Okay. On slide 62 on page 31. So we have these child and adolescent behavioral health services. I know there's been a lot of discussion about that over the years. And then we have right now an issue with the children's residential mental health services that, if I'm using the right term, that we, we have a little bit of a fiscal gap to fill there. And that was a bill that was vetoed in the last round in the big bill, and now is probably going to come back and so on. And I'm just wondering if there's any overlap there. The ones that we're talking about needing the gap funding for, just so members understand, are, you know, the federal government has these rules about you're not allowed to have institutions of mental disease, they call them, very archaic term. Essentially, some years back, they said if you've got more than 16 beds, we're not going to fund it because it's an institution for mental disease. And so we've got some of these facilities. They're private or private nonprofits, most of them. I think they're both for-profit and nonprofit mix around the state that are residential treatment for children with very high-level mental health needs. And they've been told recently you don't qualify anymore for the federal match. So the state is in this awkward situation of having to fill the gap, certainly in the short term and then perhaps longer term. So my question to Mr. Chun, with all that background, is whether there's overlap with the services that are being provided by the state here, because I know these are also services for children with very severe needs. Mm-hmm. These are state-funded. The other things are paid for by through MA and so on, but they're not state organizations. So can you help me sort that out a little bit?
Madam Chair, and Representative Liebling, I would just have to get back to you on this. This is an area that Sarah Sunderman normally covers. So.
Okay. I could have shortened the question, but thank you.
It was a great educational moment there. Thank you. Okay. Would you like to continue?
Madam Chair, that had just concluded our presentation, so we are done with our slides.
That is awesome. Wow. Okay. So let me just give some updates. First, I just want to say thank you. Thank you so much from the nonpartisan House research staff for your presentation, and just want to thank the members for enduring such an exhausting but incredible important information. So please just, you know, take some time to keep this information and go over it as needed as we go through this committee. I would like to share a little bit of information about the upcoming week ahead. On Tuesday, January the 22nd, the committee will welcome Commissioner Jan Malcolm from the Department of Health to provide an overview of the agency's structure and legislative priorities. On Wednesday, January the 23rd, we will welcome Commissioner Tony Laurie from DHS to provide a similar presentation on behalf of his agency. And then on Friday, January the 25th, the opioid informational hearing hosted by the Miltlack Banner Ojibwe. Members should have received by now an email this afternoon with the details for that hearing. Please reply to that email. and RSVP by this Friday. By this Friday. Or speak with our committee administrator, Chris, here, after we adjourn today. Okay, I think that's pretty much it. All right, okay. Before we leave out, we don't have any more questions. We are adjourned.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure it's a lot of information overload. It's so many programs.
I'll be there.